Was this the week Leicester won the league? No, it's only February, but after two key wins leave the Foxes five clear, Claudio Ranieri's team has control of the Premier League's title race. We'll talk about the leaders' trip to the Etihad, Spurs and Arsenal trying to stay close, as well as intrigue further down the table, Saints' surge, Liverpool's walkout, and the battle of wounded giants at Stamford Bridge. Welcome everybody to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. Round 25 of the Premier League season is in the books, and at least at the top of the league, we're starting to see some rhyme and some reason. Leicester has a 5-point gap, but there's also a 6-point gap between 4th and 5th place. Are we finally starting to get some clarity in what's been a very confusing Premier League season? Let's ask our co-host Kartik Krishnayar. And Kartik, what do you think? Those gaps I mentioned hint there's some more certainty as far as the title and Champions League races are concerned. But are you buying those hints? Are you any more certain about how the league will play out?
I am more certain now about how the league will play out than I was a week ago. Yes. No question.
Okay, so why don't we start at the top? We're going to get to Leicester City, break that down in a minute, but just at the top, Leicester 5-point lead. Do you think it's time for everybody to just let their doubts drift away with this team?
Yeah, the table doesn't lie at this point, okay? They've had their swoons. They've had a few injuries, nothing substantial.
But they're not experienced, Kartik. They've never been here before.
Right, but they have a fantastic team spirit. We can make that case about Spurs also. They've never been here before.
We can make the case about Arsenal. They haven't won the league with this group.
And they have a very young person. With Arsenal, we could make that case. No, I if you look individually at how each member of that team is performing in their role, in the setup that Ranieri has created for them. And look, this run, which started under Nigel Pearson a year ago, and we can talk about that a little bit and how last season played out, began about a year ago. This is now there's basically 38 games of evidence that this is a good team. This is a very good team. Hmm. So I don't see any reason why people continue to think, and I'm still seeing some doubts. They're less than they were a week ago, less than they were 3 weeks ago, obviously. But to think that this team's going to fall out of the top four, to me, there's no way they're falling out of the top four. They are cemented in a Champions League place.
They have a 12-point lead on fifth place Manchester United. Beyond the fact that, as you said, for about a year now, they've played better than Manchester United. So it's not only that they have to give those 12 points back to United, they have to be passed by three other teams in addition to Manchester United. It's the fact that every piece of evidence we have says that they are a better team, including the result on Saturday at the Etihad, Leicester City scoring in the third minute through Robert Huth, who scored a second goal in the 60th minute. By that time, Riyad Mahrez had scored. Sergio Aguero getting a consolation goal to make the scoreline look a little better than the actual play on the field. 3-1 win for the Foxes. Kartik, let's start with Leicester first, because there's going to be a lot to talk about with Manchester City too, but let's give the Foxes their due. I thought this was a great performance by them.
Yeah, they were all over Manchester City. And the general consensus, even from Manchester City supporters, and these are the sorts of supporters I see on message boards after games, making excuses, blaming referees, blaming injuries. The general consensus, we were well done by Leicester, and 3-1 is a flattering scoreline for Manchester City. These are the same types of people who are saying the 4-1 against Spurs and the 4-1 against Liverpool were basically phony scorelines. So that kind of gives you the view that Leicester were all over Manchester City in this match. They were up for the occasion. Ranieri had obviously drilled into them after that victory against Liverpool on Tuesday. Quick turnaround, but the importance of this game, the importance of scoring early and getting on top of Manchester City. We've seen Manchester City have to chase games all season. Just a few weeks ago, falling behind West Ham within a minute at the Bowling Ground, they chased that game back. But Leicester hasn't given up a lead all season, right? If Leicester gets ahead in a game, they either win or draw, generally win. And the game was essentially over with that goal by Robert Huth after a wonderful move by Mahrez. You don't give Mahrez that kind of space to operate and get the ball on his left foot. Kolarov had no choice but to foul him at that point. Otherwise, he's setting up Vardy or Okazaki for a goal. Masterful game plan from Leicester, and it just all went from there. Mahrez was brilliant. And honestly, Richard, this might seem like hyperbole. When do we start talking about Mahrez as one of the best wide players, one of the best wingers in world football? Because he's got to be there. You've got to put him up there with the top wide players.
Yeah, that's a great question. My instinct says that we can talk about it with a caveat. We can say at his best, because Mahrez had two or three really good months to start the season, and then 2 months after some some injuries, I think, or some small knocks where he was even coming off the bench for a little bit, where he wasn't his normal self. And we were starting to ask the questions, well, can Leicester maintain this with Mahrez and Vardy starting to regress a little bit and come back to their mean? And then this weekend, we see Mahrez as one of the stars of that match. So maybe we can say at his best, Mahrez is as dangerous a wide-to-in player in the world, and we just have to wait for that little bit more of consistency to see if he can take his career from going from somebody who was hopping from France to the second division in England to now somebody who's one of the best players in England, see if he can go from that to somebody who is consistently a star player. But you know, you mentioned that where he beat Kolarov and Delph really early to set up that first goal, and then he provided the assist on that goal too. I think we should come back to that because I think that moment said a lot about how Pellegrini was set up for the game. But even in those first moments for Leicester, in the whole first half, in the whole game, it was an interesting comment on the importance of that tactic, so to speak, or what tactics really are important. We, over the last 5 years, have seen so many people talk about formations and different variations of that, the use of style, the prominence of the possession game now. Leicester reminds us of some more basic things, Kartik, the value of just running your ass off, the value of believing in what you were doing, the value of execution, and the value of winning those one-on-one battles, so many of which were apparent on Mahrez's goal. It's really just a back-to-basics approach by Ranieri that has Leicester pulling off this fairy tale.
Yeah, Craig Burley this past week on ESPN had said for the program we get here in the States, I think you can get that globally, but probably not in the UK. But Craig Burley, who's now in the States, obviously used to be a co-commentator on Sky for many years for Premier League games. Burley said that flat out this week when, after the Liverpool match, that we've been hearing about inverted wingers and overloaded midfields and all of these tactical nuances that managers have introduced in the last 5 to 7 years in world football. What Ranieri has done is gone back to basics, put out his best team and highlighted one-on-one matchups and basically told Albrighton, you're going to be matched up with this guy, beat him one-on-one. Mahrez, same thing. Vardy, run into this space. Very basic tactics, but he's still done a good job of managing the team. Well, we know he's done a great job managing the team, but one of the reasons he's done a good job, as Burley said, was because he has put the players in those one-on-one matchups in a position where they can succeed, knowing the opposition and setting up to maximize potential for success.
It's been a triumph for the whole organization so far. The people who have made the decisions to bring in players like Fuchs and Okazaki and Conte, and then you have players who are already there that are performing so well. Kasper Schmeichel, Wes Moore, Morgan, Robert Huth, Jamie Vardy, of course, Riyad Mahrez, of course. It's just a pleasure to watch for so many reasons. And I think that's the context for Manchester City. The result, the bottom line was really bad. And we expect a team with the talent that Manuel Pellegrini has to perform better. I don't think this was necessarily a catastrophic performance on their part, Kartik. I think it's just a performance that shows that they probably aren't up to the title challenge this year.
No, it wasn't a catastrophic performance. But what it was is this was a big game. This wasn't, no offense, but this wasn't Sunderland at home or a trip to St. James Park to play Newcastle. This was a match against the league leaders. I don't care that it's Leicester City and not Chelsea or Manchester United. It was the league leaders coming into the weekend with a 3-point cushion over you and you're sitting second. You have to raise your game to that level because you know they're going to. They've gotten to the top of the table for a reason. And Manchester City's inability to go to another gear that we've seen them repeatedly go to in these sorts of matches is a cause for concern. And I think ultimately, two factors here. One, the managerial change that we've kind of suspected is coming, but now we officially all know it's coming. Some of the players on this Manchester City team thinking, well, this is going to be my last hurrah anyway with this side. Maybe we can win the League Cup final against Liverpool, and then it's all she wrote. It's not my show anymore. And I think the second thing is just the aging of the squad. The squad looks a little bit like Chelsea did a few seasons ago before Jose Mourinho came back. Aging, kind of trying to get the last run out of guys like Drogba and guys like Florent Malouda even and Ashley Cole and Frank Lampard. It's beginning. Yaya Toure and David Silva in particular exemplify this. And the spine of the Manchester City side, and I think this is important, Bergiristan is one of the reasons why Pep has chosen Manchester City over Chelsea or Manchester United, his relationship with Bergiristan and Soriano. Mm-hmm. But since Bergiristan has been the director of football, I would say the only consistently successful core player Manchester City has signed is Fernandinho, who was okay again in this game, had a lot of ground to cover and was maybe put in a tough position as far as his responsibilities for this match. That core of Silva, Aguero, Torre, Kompany, Kolarov, obviously Joe Hart was an inherited player, Zabaleta, all bought under the previous regime that ran the club, whether it be manager Roberto Mancini or director of football Brian Marwood. So I think that the squad is aged and it wasn't bought by this brass, and it's probably going to get blown up over the summer.
Very interesting. Well, we'll see how that happens. Obviously, big changes are going to happen at the Etihad, whether that involves just the technical staff or it also involves the playing squad. Let's talk about some of Manuel Pellegrini's decisions. The decision to play Fabian Delph in kind of that center-left role that we have seen from him often since he'd gotten healthy. I don't think many people had a problem with that because of the presence of Riyad Mahrez. The one thing that you and I talked about before the show and that just dawned on me throughout that whole first half where City really didn't generate very many good chances is it just seemed like they were short an attacker, Kartik. We're used to seeing City play with one or two forwards and then two or three attacking midfielders. And when you drop this formation on paper, you could count Yaya Toure amongst the attackers, but that really functionally was not his role, at least in the first half on Saturday. What we saw was Aguero isolated, Raheem Sterling apparently supposed to bridge that gap, David Silva having to fall back to right midfield in the defensive phase and then make that space up in the attacking phase. And it just did not seem to work. Kartik put all of those guys in situations where they had to win their individual battles every time and get help from their teammates to put them in good positions. And against a Leicester team that has thrived on winning those individual battles, it seemed like a losing plan.
Yeah, and obviously Pellegrini hamstrung by not having Jesus Navas, Kevin De Bruyne, or Samir Nasri due to injury. That having been said, it was still a situation where he had to put Delph where he put him, and I don't find that an odd decision at all because of Mahrez. So you have to play him a little further out left to account for the danger man for the other side, which meant that Yaya Toure had more responsibility as a two-way player than he normally would. Because Delph is not covering that space.
That's a recipe for disaster.
That's a recipe for disaster. So maybe the one change he could have made was not start Toure at all and play Fernandinho further higher up the pitch and play Fernando behind him.
Yeah, maybe. I guess I also wonder if maybe just go to a straight kind of conventional 4-4-2 and put Iheanacho in there.
Yeah, that would have been the other option,
yeah,
right?
And instead of trying to rely on
them, that would have worked better. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think Leicester were going to lose this game or even draw this game regardless the way they played, but it probably would have made it less ugly. And again, the scoreline, as even Manchester City supporters are saying, it flatters Manchester City. It was a very one-sided match.
Yeah, this goes back to what we were talking about a couple seconds ago. You can talk about the tactics all you want, but if your players are going to lose the type of one-on-one battles that we saw Conte and Mahrez win on that second goal, you're probably not going to win the game regardless of the brilliance of your plan. The one other thing that I want to mention with City before we get to the rundown is we have seen this constantly ever since Vincent Kompany got injured, the inability of their center backs to win one-on-one battles, whether it be on set pieces, as we saw Martin Demichelis come up short twice on Saturday, or in open play where we constantly see Nicola Otamendi come up short, and he did on the second goal. To me, Kartik, this is why I am so definitive about saying City doesn't look like a title contender. Kompany is starting to return to training. We don't know when he's actually going to be back. We don't know for how long he'll be back before injuring his calf again. With so many uncertainties in their central defense, I just wonder why they've allowed their squad to be in this position where they're relying on two guys that can't win one-on-one battles.
Yeah, and also, as what's also prominently discussed on the City message boards last night, Mangala supposedly had a knock in training and now he's been out a month. So he obviously would have been a massive upgrade over those two guys just from the one-on-one standpoint. And he's a player I think is going to benefit, even though he's been frustrating in his City career thus far. Mm-hmm. He's the player I can say, maybe besides Samir Nasri, that's going to benefit the most from Pep Guardiola coming in. Maybe we don't give Pellegrini credit for this because he ultimately didn't do it, but he realized he had this problem coming into this titanic showdown with Leicester, and he was very actively considering playing Bakary Sagna, who is a small guy but quick and understands his positioning as a center back, instead of either Di Michaelis or Otamendi, because he knew the one-on-one battles and the quickness and that sort of thing. He needed a more tenacious defender and a defender with a good sense of positioning but also closing speed, and he doesn't have that with either Otamendi and Di Michaelis. So he thought about doing it. Ultimately, he didn't, and it cost him.
Well, we spent a lot of time on this one game, more time than we usually spend on any single game over the weekend, but it was 1-2. It did involve the story of the season, Leicester City, and it did involve the league-leading team going from a two-point gap to now having a firm grip on first place in the English Premier League. But elsewhere, on Sunday and Saturday at Anfield, where a 77th-minute fan protest was poised to steal the headlines, but with Jurgen Klopp hospitalized with an appendicitis, Sunderland came back from a two-goal deficit, scoring twice late to take a 2-2 draw from Liverpool. Newcastle got a goal from Alexander Mitrovic and became the sixth team this season to hold West Brom without a shot on target, winning 1-0 at St. James's Park. Everton pounced on Stoke early and often, winning 3-0 at the Britannia. An early Gylfi Sigurdsson goal was equalized by Scott Dan as Crystal Palace got a 1-1 at Swansea. Tottenham dominated the game, if not the scoreline, in a 1-0 win over visiting Watford. Aston Villa continued flaming their embers of hope with a 2-0 win over Norwich. Southampton scored early, lost a man, then held on to beat visiting West Ham 1-0. On Sunday, Arsenal scored goals in the 23rd and 24th minutes to claim a 2-0 win at Bournemouth, and Chelsea got a stoppage time goal from Diego Costa to draw visiting Manchester United 1-1. With round 25 in the books, Leicester has breathing room at the top. Their 50.3 points leave them 5 clear of Spurs and Arsenal, both on 48, with Manchester City now 4th, another point back. United's missed opportunity at Stamford Bridge leaves them 6 points off the Champions League pace, with West Ham and Southampton in the league's next 2 spots. At the bottom of the table, Aston Villa is up to 16 points, though that's still 8 from safety. Sunderland, having gotten their point from Anfield, is in 19th place with 20 points, while Norwich, losers of 5 in a row, have fallen into the bottom 3. They're 23 points, 1 fewer than Newcastle United. When we return, we'll jump back to the top of the league, albeit with a very London focus. Tottenham, Arsenal, and because we're nostalgic, Chelsea and United at the Bridge. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. World Soccer Talk Podcast. Let's start trickling our way down the table. We talked about the 1-2 battle in the first segment of the show. I think we'll go ahead and talk about Chelsea United here just to be nostalgic and acknowledge the fact that there are a ton of Chelsea United fans, not only in the world, but listen to this podcast. So let's go ahead and jump into this, even though neither of these teams are really a factor in the title race. John Terry's last game against Manchester United had some emotional value for that. Jesse Lingard scoring the first goal, Diego Costa in stoppage time. Overall, Kartik, a good performance by Manchester United that was kind of undone by a young player's mistake at the end.
Yeah, this is something that's interesting to me because I think Manchester United, the first half of the season, I'll take it till that draw with Leicester City in that when Vardy broke the record, Manchester United were getting better results than their level of play. They were getting draws in games they should have lost. They were winning games they should have drawn. Now, and then they have that really rough patch over the festive period, over Christmas, when everybody said Van Gaal's getting the sack and they were losing games. Now, I think in the last month, starting with the game against Swansea, and culminating today, going through the Liverpool game, although the Liverpool game, I guess, could fit the pattern of the first half of the season, but taking that Liverpool game out of it, their performances have been better than their results. So games they should have won, like today, they draw. Games they should have drawn, they've lost, like the Southampton game. And I think it's one of those things that we see over 38 game seasons where it evens out over time. So the results aren't any different for United. They haven't been different all season. However, the performances are getting better. We're seeing better play from Wayne Rooney. I thought Juan Mata was better in that number 10 role today until he got pulled off. Lingard is a certain upgrade over Memphis Depay. Miles better.
Yeah. Right, remember I seriously have not heard his name in 2 months.
Right. We probably haven't talked about him in any way, shape, or form on this show since September. So he's a massive upgrade, as it turns out. This is a lesson, though, for in this era of big spending, TV money, sometimes the answers at your club lie within your own system, your own academy. There was no need to spend all that money on Memphis. They had Lingard, and he's performing at a much higher level now consistently than Memphis ever did. Martial has gotten back to a pretty good level. So I like the way United's playing, but they didn't get the result. And ultimately, Costa made them pay, and Chelsea is finding ways to get draws in games that they really don't deserve draws in.
Yeah, let's talk about that in a second, because I think we're going to switch to your favorite topic here, Kartik, on both sides of this, because the specter of Jose Mourinho still looms large over both of these sides. Rumors picking up this week, and this is a little bit disconcerting to me because I'm not seeing the reporting to necessarily support this. People are starting to assume that Jose Mourinho is just going to be at Manchester United this summer. You see your fans talk about this. I read on a Chelsea blog yesterday how they're just assuming that Jose is going to migrate with Pep up to Manchester this summer. Are you under the assumption that that's just a given at this point?
Well, that's going to really bother Pep, because I mean, he can't stand
it. I hadn't even thought about that. That's going to be now I'm rooting for this to happen. I didn't care before. Yeah, now I want this to happen.
That wasn't part of the deal. Well, I mean, he can still back out on Nancy if that happens.
Wow, that's going to be spectacular. I can't even think about that. That's like if both of them went to the Milan team at the same time.
That could be amazing, because we know that that's a personal rivalry, and that
that's amazing.
Mourinho has been very effective at goading Guardiola into saying some things that Guardiola, who's generally very controlled and image conscious, doesn't say about other managers or other in other circumstances. So, which is Jose's talent, right? He has a talent for that, in provoking these sorts of reactions. No, we haven't seen any reporting on this. Louis van Gaal today after the match, very angry reporters who asked him the question, threw it back at the reporter. What if I were to broadcast that you're getting the sack in the morning?
I don't blame him. Just answering the same question over and over again. Like, at least wait a couple of weeks or wait for something new to happen.
I mean, have you talked to Ed Woodward? Have you talked to the Glazer family? And the reporters, they haven't.
Yeah. At the same time, you suspect that the reporter's only asking these questions to get the exact kind of response they got today, to see if Van Gaal will erupt or crack or say something stupid. And that way, it's kind of like this, I don't know, this Faustian bargain, like where both sides are doing stupid
things. Analysis of Manchester United's play. I mean, we do it on this show, but other places, it's all about, well, is he going to get sacked after this game? Mourinho's coming in. And I think and even today he said, well, what about Fergie's first few seasons? Van Gaal might be in his mind thinking, rationalizing a scenario in which he stays in this job, which I don't think he's going to stay in the job past the summer. But as Robbie Musto here in the States on NBC pointed out after the broadcast, there's no need to rush into Mourinho from his perspective, that there will be managers available after the European Championships.
Absolutely.
International managers who might want to come back to the club level, even a guy like Conte, maybe in Italy, a manager like that who will be available for Manchester United. So why rush to Mourinho when you've got a whole 6 months to play out?
I just can't believe they missed out on Ancelotti. It just seems like the one person that is so perfect for that scenario. And then they let him go to Bayern, although that would have entailed firing Louis van Gaal earlier. But now it seems like that would have been worth the risk, considering we're starting to see managers kind of slot into places where they're going to land. I think the one exception here is that I think it'd be very interesting if Manchester United then went and got Manuel Pellegrini, because I also think he'd be a good fit for them too.
The assumption now is that Pellegrini might go to Chelsea. That seems to think people.
Yeah, I think I like him going to Valencia more than I like him going to Chelsea for some reason. Although I think both of those would be good fits for him. I think Pellegrini's going to have a lot of options. Let's talk about the other side of Mourinho's life. Let's talk about Chelsea. Chelsea is not losing games at this point. They also don't look very good. I think you can say that they've kind of stemmed the bleeding, but the patient isn't exactly recovering as quickly as people would have wanted him to. What does this say about the move to fire Mourinho, Kartik? There hasn't been this big turnaround with anybody but Diego Costa. Yet you can still kind of see that maybe they just needed to get rid of Mourinho just to stabilize.
Yeah, Fabregas, I think, has played better.
He was so pro Mourinho too. That's the thing. He went out of his way to say that he didn't want Jose to be fired. He wasn't the rat that people thought he was.
Right. But Fabregas and Costa are two players. Costa dramatically. We can have that conversation.
Do you think suspiciously improved?
Well, that's what I was.
Because I mean, that's what we're starting to hear from people.
We're starting to hear that. There's lots of speculation online, even match commentators saying that. It may just be as simple as Heating being a more attack-oriented manager that plays to the strengths of a single striker. Maybe.
This is so bad, Kartik. People are starting to, without proof, call Diego Costa probably the worst thing you can call a player. I think probably the worst thing you can call a player is somebody that actually hurts other players intentionally. Maybe the second worst is somebody that's willing to compromise other people's jobs. And that's what they're saying about Diego Costa, that essentially he intentionally played poorly so Jose Mourinho would be fired.
Yes, and I don't really believe that's the case. Now, is he maybe more enthusiastic about coming to training every day with Goose Heading and then playing in matches? Yes, but that happens in every dressing room. There's a manager that lost that dressing room or has said some of the things that Jose Mourinho said publicly about his players. So, yeah, clearly Costa's giving a greater effort for Heading, but I don't think that meant he wanted Mourinho necessarily was trying or had some sort of master plan to get Mourinho sacked. The thing I will say about Chelsea's performances, they continue to be a bad team. Just like we're saying, the table doesn't lie anymore. Leicester are a good team. They're the best team in this league. Chelsea are one of the worst teams in this league. The table doesn't lie. And I have to say, given the circumstances around Mourinho, the vibe in the dressing room, Chelsea would have been right in this square in the middle of this relegation battle had they not sacked him. Yeah. They haven't picked up results the way they wanted to under Heading. I know when Heading got named manager, a lot of Chelsea supporters were telling me, oh, you know, we're not going to make Champions League, but we're still going to make Europa League. We're going to surge up the table. Hasn't happened, but they've stabilized. They're not going to get relegated now. And another manager comes in next year and starts off.
The more we see Chelsea play, Karthik, the more I like the theory that we talked about a little bit at the beginning of the season, that Chelsea just does not have good players right now. That for 2 years, Jose Mourinho, I think we all acknowledge for his abrasiveness, is a very accomplished and very good manager, at least for a short period of time. For 2 years, he was able to paper over those cracks. And in a Premier League that's weakening, it seems like right now, is maybe in a little bit of a wane before it eventually takes its money and builds again, he was able to claim a title. But then this year, he just wasn't able to do it. It was just too much. The age and lack of quality in the team just got to where he couldn't do it. And then he's just not the manager you want to try to guide a team through those struggles.
Inability for so many years to get a second striker. Since Nicolas Anelka left to go to China now 4 or 5 years ago, they haven't had a second striker.
They had Fernando Torres. Do you remember how good he was?
Yeah, I mean, but it's just been one bad buy after another. Yeah. Now that was an overpriced buy, but even when they've gone on the cheap with Dembaba or Lokremi, it hasn't worked. So when Costa was in that dip in form, which again, I mean, I don't want to get, we're not getting conspiratorial. I don't think he was intentionally trying to get Mourinho sacked, but when he was in that dip, they didn't have another striker to play.
We talked a lot about Chelsea, Manchester United, because the other two games we want to talk about in this segment, there really isn't a lot to talk about. Let's start with Arsenal. A lot of people looking for them to rebound after a tough stretch here, one that saw them come into the weekend in fourth place. 2-0 win at Bournemouth, goals in the 23rd and 24th minute from Mesut Ozil, and a really nice finish from Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. So let's answer the implicit question here, Karthik. Are you convinced enough by this performance to say that Arsenal is ready to rebound?
No. We'll find out a lot about them next week. They're playing the best team in the league. They're playing them at home. They're one of two teams that's defeated Leicester City this season. But based on this performance and the last six or seven data points we have, I have no reason to believe. I know we don't make our predictions till Wednesday, but I have no reason to believe Arsenal will beat Leicester next week. I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, I'm with you. The only reason that we have to believe that Arsenal will beat Leicester is what Arsenal did against Leicester earlier this season at the King Power Stadium, and you have to balance that against what we know of these teams now. Another North London team, one that has been playing much better than Arsenal, arguably playing as good as Leicester right now, as well as Leicester right now. Tottenham with a 1-0 win over Watford. Such a weird game, Karthik, because it didn't seem like Watford came out to play. Three defensive midfielders in the middle of the formation to start this. They dropped Troy Deeney, only played Odion Ighalo up front. They didn't have a shot on target this whole match. Spurs had 9, eventually Kieran Trippier scoring in the second half. It just seemed like one of those goals that eventually, once you give a team enough room, they're going to create an opportunity like that, and Tottenham did.
Yeah, Kiki Sanchez Flores went to a kind of a negative system in this match because of the danger from Spurs midfield. I completely understand why he did it. The Deeney-Ighalo partnership, you didn't want to break up, but what resulted was by dropping Deeney, Ighalo wasn't getting those balls. He wasn't getting the guy to hold up play who serves as kind of, and we've talked about this before with Watford, even though it's a 4-4-2 on paper, Deeney can drop into midfield and kind of play as a target number 9.5 or whatever you want to call it, a target number 10 that you play through and Ighalo can run off. So they had no attacking impetus at all. The thing I really like about this now is you're seeing Pochettino able to rotate players. They're still alive in three competitions. Mm-hmm. Trippier comes in for Kyle Walker. You've seen Davies come in for Rose Davies, that switch. You've seen Tom Carroll come in. and they continue to get results. They continue to look good in the process. This team is deeper than people thought. They didn't spend the kind of money they normally do. And it was such a healthy sign for Spurs that instead of the panic we used to have in January with Redknapp trying to make an offer for this one and that one and Levy vetoing it and Llorente and Aguero, all these guys that Spurs almost bought before they ended up in other destinations or tried to buy. Willian was another one. Pochettino says, I like my team, to Levy. Levy's like, I trust you. You've earned my trust based on the results. I've never had a season this good since we've been in the Premier League or since the Premier League began. You don't want to buy anyone? We're not going to do anything. Spurs' calmness in the transfer window showed me a lot about where this club is headed, because we have never seen a transfer window with so little drama from Spurs.
Yeah, we can do a whole show on Spurs, because not only has the depth become admirable, they rotated out their fullbacks and their wingers this weekend. Not only are they challenging for a title, but they're in this weird situation. When you look at that team, it's hard to pick out any players that you would say are definitely going to leave or definitely get
and
coached.
That was the point I was going to make just now, Richard, was that there is this assumption that Pochettino, Real Madrid will want him, Manchester United will want him, Chelsea will want him. But the reason you would leave Spurs in the past was because they always sell their best players. Berbatov, Carrick, Modric, Bale, obviously, Bale being the most prominent one. It doesn't look like Spurs need to do that anymore. It looks like he can keep this core together, and their core is younger and potentially better than any of the teams I mentioned, including Real Madrid. It's a younger core than Real Madrid. It may not be better, certainly better than Manchester United or Chelsea. There's really no reason for Pochettino to leave.
Well, everybody, we're going to go ahead and take our break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Real Madrid, the German League, the Spanish League, update you on Europe before we move to the next section of the table, talk about Southampton, West Ham, and talk about the walkout at Liverpool. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk podcast. Over to Europe briefly, and we start in Germany, where those powerful, invulnerable Bayern Munich were held to a 0-0 at Bayer Leverkusen, a match that saw both teams combine for only two shots in the first half of the game. Conceivably, that result left the door open for powerful, only slightly more vulnerable Borussia Dortmund to trim Bayern's league lead to six. But they were also held to a 0-0 this weekend, that one at Hertha Berlin, a team who kept hold of third place in the Bundesliga and are now six games unbeaten. Kartik?
I have to mention on the Dortmund game that 17-year-old Christian Pulisic, one of our great hopes in American soccer, American football, whatever you want to call it, got a run-in, a shift in that game up top as a striker, which he's not. But after Ramos got subbed out, he played okay. I mean, he didn't get as many touches as we'd like, but he's one of the great hopes for American soccer, and he's already worked his way into the first team at Dortmund. Made his debut the previous week, incidentally.
And of course, there's another prominent young American that was playing on the other team, John Brooks, maybe the best defender we have in the pool right now, at least after this last couple games.
Yeah, one of
the
two or three best players the U.S. has, probably.
Yeah, we're getting to that point. Elsewhere in Germany, a little bit farther down the table, it was kind of a weird stellar weekend for the next level of clubs in the league, the ones right behind Germany's big two. Beyond Hertha and Bayer, who got good results against the league's titans, there was Schalke, inconsistent, agonizing reputation as being this unpredictable team. Schalke got a 3-0 win over a Wolfsburg team that is kind of in free fall right now, but Schalke is now in fourth place, the league's last Champions League spot. It's a bit of a head scratcher, that position, because Schalke is that inconsistent side that was kind of in turmoil earlier this year, but they still have the talent to hold down that spot if they can bring things together. But just behind them, Bayer is only a point back, and they're even with a Gladbach team that throttled Werder Bremen 5-1 on Friday. So Gladbach's not going anywhere either. Even a little step down from that, not to be too Bundesliga-centric here, there's Mainz. Mainz is in seventh place right now, or fighting for the league's last Europa League spot, and they got a 1-0 win on the road against Hanover. Although there's a bit of a caveat there, Hanover have now lost six in a row, and they look like they're finally destined to drop down to the second division.
I have to say this. I sat through several press conferences with Brain Ritter over the winter break, the Schalke manager, thinking he was a dead man walking, because things were, even in the winter break, didn't go well, and Hovedis got injured, and it seemed Schalke went into that winter break seventh or eighth, and they weren't playing well. And now they're back in the Champions League position. So that league is very competitive beyond the top two teams. However, first and second in that league are both locked in. There's an 8-point gap between first and second. There's a 10 or 12 point gap between second and third. So it's not that compelling, but it does show that there's a lot of movement from 3 to 8.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over to Spain, where Barcelona entered the weekend off a midweek Copa del Rey drubbing of Valencia 7-0. On Sunday, though, their tanks were a little bit empty as the holders only had a Levante own goal to show for themselves going into stoppage time. Luis Suarez, however, scored his league-leading 20th goal of the season to double the Blaugrana's lead, giving the leaders a 2-0 win on the road. Elsewhere, Atletico rebounded from last week's disappointment against Barcelona with a 3-1 win over Eibar, while Real Madrid, with a little more trouble than expected against relegation and battle Granada, came out of the weekend with a 2-1 result. They stay 4 points back of the lead in third place. Atleti is 1 point better. They're in second. Barcelona is still safe at the top, and they still have a match in hand. As far as the big story in Spain, there's Gary Neville, who all eyes have turned to after Valencia's midweek loss. Another huge disappointment this weekend for Gary Neville. On the back of last weekend's loss against relegation-battled Sporting Gijón, Valencia's lost again to Real Betis this weekend, another 1-0. Even in the face of that, sources have told The Guardian Sid Lowe that there are no plans to dismiss Neville right now, despite Valencia still winless in league under him. Kartik, it has not been a good couple of years for English coaches in Spain.
No, it hasn't, although David Moyes showed some signs at Santander, and it just went very bad this season for him, and he was dismissed quickly, and there are quicker triggers. Believe it or not, fans who watch English football may not believe this, but in Spain and Italy, managers get sacked a lot quicker than they do in England. And Moyes actually did okay last season and showed some promise, and maybe we thought, okay, he can hack it long term. Neville has never gotten out of the gate, so it's not. I don't even think they're comparable situations. And again, that's the difference between a guy like Moyes. Yes, it didn't go well at Manchester United, but his Everton record speaks for itself, his record at Preston, and a guy in Gary Neville who has never managed before.
Yeah. And in Moyes' defense, it's not like Sociedad has leapt up the table without
No. In fact, I think they avoided relegation last year largely because he was their manager. So he got results against Real Madrid. Did he get a result against Barcelona last year?
Yeah, that was the game where Neymar and Messi both started on the bench and sent the team into that temporary spiral where people thought Luis Enrique was going to get fired.
That's right, yeah. But so Moyes beat both the big guns last season, whereas Neville, he got fortunate to get that draw against Real Madrid, although they were down to 10 men, and then got absolutely humiliated by Barca midweek in the Copa del Rey semifinals. Mm-hmm. There is a second leg to play in that. I mean, I can't imagine how bad it's going to be.
Yeah, on one hand, it could be a chance for some measure of redemption for the team, but then they went out this weekend and they got shut out again. They're not scoring goals. They're not winning games. They're not even drawing games anymore. It looks really bad there. And they hadn't just dismissed a coach. You would say that Gary Neville was a dead man walking. Who knows what they're going to do now? Let's jump back to the Premier League. Kartik, our players of the week. I'm going to go ahead and go first, and I'm going to stay focused on the marquee matchup of the week. Such a great performance by Leicester. There are two or three players you could pick out here. I think even somebody like Jamie Vardy, his contributions are becoming a little bit overlooked because he's not getting onto the score sheet as often, although he did against Liverpool, obviously. He's still winning so many balls and creating chances up top, but I'm going to go with the person that's obvious if you look at the score sheet. I'm going to go with Robert Huth. I thought the team had a very good defensive performance, and not to diminish Wes Morgan's contributions to that, I thought Robert Huth was very good there. And you get a central defender scoring two goals, being that dangerous on set pieces, taking advantage of Martin Demichelis. I thought that he had a player of the week caliber performance.
That's interesting. Okay, so that takes Huth away from me. I've still got Mahrez on my list, Vardy, Okazaki, Conte, and Wes Morgan, all Leicester players. So I'm going to go with Mahrez. What a maestro he's become. I mean, I can imagine the kind of adjectives and calls we'd have from Ray Hudson on BN if he were playing in Spain. I mean, this guy is a maestro now on the ball, especially when he ends up being isolated against defenders like Otamendi, who aren't good one-on-one man-marking defenders, right? But it's become really a joy to watch the guy, and we thought, well, he had hit a dip. He missed those two penalties in successive games. Now, think about where Leicester would be in the table if he had made those penalties. But he's just been incredible, and he gets his teammates involved. I also want to point out Vardy had that incredible strike midweek, but it was the long ball from Mahrez that was perfectly placed right into space where he knew Vardy would run that set up that wonder goal, which to me is the second best goal of the season behind Dele Alli's goal against Palace a few weeks ago. The understanding between Mahrez, Vardy, and Okazaki and Albrighton, those four players in particular, unbelievable. It's something we haven't seen in the league, and I think I've said this before on the show, since the early days of Mourinho at Chelsea when you had Damian Duff and Robin and Drogba and Lampard, those four making similar runs and similar movements.
And again, we mentioned this before, it's just such a testament to a coach's ability to instill some belief in a team. And maybe it'll force other teams to reconsider how they're spending their money, because it's not like Leicester is going out and making a ton of big buys, but they've made targeted buys at modest fees and have dramatically improved their club. Kartik, let's go ahead and talk about some of the games that we haven't touched on yet. And, you know, going over this segment before we started recording again, we think we realized we didn't have enough time, because subtly in these next three games, there's a lot to talk about, even if there wasn't a lot of action at St. Mary's and Southampton's 1-0 win over West Ham. Maya Yoshida getting kind of a surprise start as Ronald Koeman went to a three-man central defense, scored in the ninth minute. Vincent Wanyama sent out shortly after half time. West Ham only really coming into the game at the end, and Southampton running their winning streak, well, unbeaten streak to five, and they've won four of those games.
Yeah, Southampton playing very well. This was an interesting tactical wrinkle from Koeman, and it worked. And I think this is the sort of thing that he's been able to do to keep that defense solid in the 18 months he's been there. They didn't leak goals exactly under Pochettino, but they're even more stout defensively. They have a couple of blips this season where they've given up three goals, but to take those matches out of it, their defense is about as good as anyone in the league. The other team that's been really good defensively is Pochettino's Spurs, but he has a more expensive back four that he can call on. So
he has one of Koeman's defenders from last year too.
Right. He has Alderweireld, who's arguably the best central defender in England at this point. So you've got just some interesting tactical wrinkles. Unfortunately, this game was marred again by Wanyama getting sent off. This is the third time. It was an unnecessary challenge. It was stupid. It was reckless. My understanding is, even though his previous sending offs were second yellows, because this was violent conduct, he could be suspended for as many as five games.
Well, yeah, Southampton has some new depth at that position. We saw that Ward-Prowse and Oriol Romeu started on the bench this weekend, but there isn't really a like-for-like for Wanyama there, and particularly the way that Koeman has been setting up, that destructive presence in the middle, it's just not, you just can't throw on Oriol Romeu and expect that all to be replaced.
Right, you lose that kind of ball-winning defensive stoutness, but Romeu is a player that's positionally very well, does well, and is a good two-way player.
Yeah, we saw him perform very well when he came on this weekend and almost set up a goal for Charlie Austin with a very nice piece of skill. Let's talk about West Ham here for a second. West Ham is a team, one reader reminded me last week that we tend to pass over a little bit. It's almost as if anytime they're in a marquee matchup, there's another matchup that weekend that forces our attention somewhere else. They're still sixth in the league, Kartik. Unfortunately, now that we're talking about them, it's after a loss, and it's after another performance similar to the Newcastle one, where they looked so poor at the beginning of that match, where they just didn't seem to get out of the blocks quickly in this one.
They've had a few games like this even in the first half of the season where it may have coincided with Payet's injury. So this is the first time since he's been fit that they've had a couple of matches like this. But they didn't come out of second gear this entire match, it seemed. Very slow to the ball, slow in reading the game. There's more depth in this West Ham team than a lot of teams in the league. So Village typically has selection headaches, and he seems to have made some mistakes in this match, and he tried to remedy it quickly, and it was nice to see Andy Carroll back from injury, so that gives him another option going forward. There were certain opponents, particularly a team that was playing the way Southampton was in this game, where Carroll could be useful, But it didn't pan out for West Ham. So this is an unfortunate defeat for them.
Another person that we saw come on late, Emmanuel Emenike, the 28-year-old Nigerian striker. I believe it was the deadline day that he was brought in from Turkey. He made an appearance for West Ham late in this one. Let's go to Liverpool-Sunderland, where there's a lot to talk about in the game in this one. And I almost regret passing over the fact that Liverpool gave up a 2-goal lead. And we saw Firmino have a very good performance, scoring the first goal and setting up the second one. But all attention around this game, Kartik, was focused on the stands, where Liverpool fans had organized a walkout in the 77th minute to protest a new ticket pricing scheme, one that'll see some tickets next year cost £77 per match for some of the Liverpool faithful. Kartik, this is actually a pretty complex story, particularly if you read Ian Ayres' response to the news of the protest. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's unfortunate the situation where ticket prices in England are astronomical. We were just talking about the Bundesliga, right? And I think the most expensive tickets in the Bundesliga are probably cheaper than the cheapest decent seats in the Premier League. And unfortunately, also because it's league rules that you have to sell away tickets for the same price as home tickets. If you're a Liverpool supporter and you're going to Arsenal, you're going to pay the highest ticket prices in Europe, even though your club charges less for tickets, or a Leicester City supporter, or Manchester City supporter, whoever. So there are all these issues with the ticket prices. I have to say, though, the Liverpool situation is a little complicated because they're redeveloping that ground. They're rebuilding Anfield. And there are other clubs that are charging astronomical ticket prices who have inherited stadiums, who have gotten land deals that have gotten a situation where they're making money off of other projects, like Arsenal specifically is off of the former Highbury site. Liverpool is in a position where they have to fund the rebuilding of their ground on the current ground on that property. It's a little more complicated than it is in other places. I generally sympathize with the supporters here. I'm not saying I don't in this case either, but the Liverpool situation is more complicated than just the straight high ticket prices in some other places.
Yeah, I found Ian Ayres' comments persuasive. He noted that under the new ticket pricing plan, I believe it was 45% of the tickets are actually going down. And he talked about how he personally had made a concerted effort with the committees that developed this pricing plan to note that they needed more cheaper tickets so that younger people could come to the game more often without spending as much. And part of that sacrifice is to raise tickets for some people. And he also noted that this £77 price, the inspiration for the 77th minute walkout, only affects 0.5% of the total capacity for next year's games.
I need to read that response, yeah, because I've already been predisposed, even though I'm generally with supporters and fan movements like this, I've been predisposed to be more balanced on this one because I know the situation Liverpool's in with Anfield. It's different than the situation other clubs are in. And in Arsenal specifically, since Arsenal is the poster child for high ticket prices. And I loved what the Bayern supporters did earlier in the year for that Champions League match when they went to Arsenal. But that's very interesting. That's very persuasive to me also. So they're making the game more accessible to newer fans, and, which I like.
Yeah, and at the other end, because they don't want to lose revenue, and there's another discussion to have on that, because part of supporters' claims here is that the new television packages mean you should be able to offer cheaper tickets. But there's more to this story than just the face value. And the fact that Liverpool fans have pinned so much of the media or so much of the messaging of this on that 77 number, I find a little bit disingenuous, because that 77 number does not accurately describe the scope of the ticketing plans. If Ian Ayres' numbers are right. Again, he said 0.5%, or one out of every 200 tickets at Anfield would be affected by that price. So I'm just having trouble getting behind the populism of using that number. Lots to talk about with that game, but in this segment, still want to talk about the other half of Merseyside. Everton, very strong result, 3-0 at Stoke, 3 first half goals, just jumping on a Stoke team that gave one of their worst performances of the year. Kartik, early penalty kick given up, converted by Lomelu Lukaku, very poor possession leading to Aaron Lennon's goal that closed the scoring. overall, I think positive signs for Everton, but maybe more worrisome signs for Stoke.
Yeah, Stoke without a number of regulars on that back line, just and in defensive midfield, look a mess. And they have now had consecutive games this week where they've conceded three goals. And Everton scores goals, but they weren't able to really pressure Everton. This was a one-sided game. Everton had a 3-0 against Newcastle earlier in the week, which wasn't so one-sided, honestly. That was a much more balanced game. The scoreline flattered the Toffees. This game did not, and I felt like there just wasn't a whole lot going forward for Mark Hughes in this game. He threw on Stephen Ireland. He threw on Peter Odemwingie, some old-timers at that club. Well, Ireland is not an old-timer at that club. He's a
Ireland's like a Mark Hughes security blanket.
Yeah, right. He's a Hughes player, but guys that you wouldn't expect to see on this new quote Stoke Kelowna side, and both those guys were poor, quite frankly, and weren't able to produce anything. So it was a pretty humbling game for Stoke. Now on the Everton side, that's consecutive victories. They're beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel. They're beginning to climb back up the table. They're now in eighth. The goal all along for Everton has been to make it to Europe this season. They're not going to make it to Champions League, but with this team, they've got to get to Europa League one way or another. They're now out of the League Cup. That was a missed opportunity, losing that semifinal to Manchester City. They're still alive. They are still alive in the FA Cup, right? I think. Well, I can't remember, to be honest with you. Tells you how much I've been focusing on the FA Cup. But now they are, depending on who wins the Cups, they are potentially only 2 points out of a European spot. Worst case scenario, they're only 6 points out of a European spot. So they might still make it to continental play next season.
Yeah, if you had to bet on them, or they're 4 points behind West Ham, 2 points behind Southampton, I wouldn't blame somebody for thinking Everton would overtake one of those two teams to make the top seven. Let's go ahead and take our last break right now. When we come back, we'll update you on the weekend in the championship. We'll give you our top fours, and we'll talk about the remaining matches in this, the 25th round of action in the Premier League. Stay with us. When last we talked about the championship, Steve Bruce and Hull City had claimed a somewhat improbable lead on Middlesbrough, the team that had led the second tier for most of the last 2 months. This weekend, however, that lead tightened up, and thanks to surges from Burnley and Brighton, there's some new uncertainty surrounding the championship's top two spots. Let's start at Burnley, where Hull put their 1-point league lead and 4-match winning streak on the line on Saturday, but both of those were undone in the 77th minute when Sam Vokes gave Sean Dyche's team a 1-0 win, a result that could have seen them pass Middlesbrough for second place. That's because at Middlesbrough, a struggling Blackburn team had claimed a 1-0 lead, with Sunderland loanee Jordan Gomez putting Rovers on the cusp of an improbable result. But in the 79th minute, David Nugent saved Itor Karanka's team their proverbial blushes, scoring the equalizer that allowed Burrow to preserve a 1-1 result, as well as move back even at the top of the table. So here's how that looks. Hull, thanks to their goal difference edge, is in first with 56 points, but they've played 29 games. Middlesbrough, with the same point total, has only played 28 times. And Burnley, only 1 point back of the leaders, has already played 30 times this season. Further down, Brighton continues to recapture their early season form, moving within 3 points of the top, with Friday's 3-0 win against Brentford. Derby's winless streak is at 7 after their 1-1 draw at Fulham. They're 5 points back of the top, and Sheffield Wednesday is moving deeper into the playoff spots. A valuable 2-1 win at fellow playoff hopefuls Birmingham leaves them on 50 points, and they're unbeaten now in 6. Back to the Premier League, Kartik, time for our top fours, and you have the honors.
Okay, on form, I'm going to go Leicester, Spurs, Southampton, maybe Everton. I can't believe
big exhale.
Sized Everton. Yeah, I guess I'll go Everton 4. End of the season, I'm going Leicester 1, Spurs 2, Manchester City, Arsenal 3, Manchester City 4.
Yeah, we have pretty similar lists. As far as form is concerned, I have the same top three in the same order that you do: Leicester, Spurs, and Saints. And then it took me way too long to think of a fourth team, and I ended up going with Manchester City just because, one, the rest of the league doesn't have great form, and two, Manchester City's only recent loss is to the best team in the league and the best team on my form list. So I kind of gave
pulled Everton out of thin air. I
wanted anybody but City, considering the result this weekend. But I guess part of the premise here is that City weren't so terrible. Leicester was good, so that swayed me a little bit too. As far as end of the season, number four, I have Manchester City. And that hurts because I've had City number one for most of the year, but I'm just so unconvinced by City's defense at this point that I'm putting them four in what I consider a pretty tightly packed four teams here. Number three, Arsenal, and I have them there just because I believe in the number two team, Spurs, and then number one, Leicester City. I guess we'll know a lot more about this top four next weekend after Leicester visits Arsenal. Kartik, the three games that we haven't touched on yet, let's start at the bottom of the table. Aston Villa 2-0 victory over Norwich. Villa now has 8 points in their last five games. Reason to think that they can actually survive?
most seasons, yes. Because there's generally two, three, four teams that go into the tank at the end of the season and end up going down. This season, the teams that are near the bottom in the table are not...
they're kind of giving Sunderland, each other points.
I think Sunderland I'm intrigued by the purchases Allardyce has made. The results haven't come yet, but I think they're going to come because of the guys he's brought in from the continent. Now, again, a lot of critics can say they may not acclimate to English football, but I'm already seeing signs from Kone and from Kirchhoff have.
And Wahbi Kirase had an assist on that.
Set up that goal, yeah. Right. So these guys are already beginning to acclimate. Kirchhoff may be really one of the best buys, even though he was a washout at Bayern. Allardyce is putting him in midfield, and it seems to be working. So because of that...
Oh, my God. That him and Catterall and Villa in midfield. Jesus.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that's a brick wall, right?
it's a midfield Tony Pulis would love.
Yeah, right. Although a guy like Kaziri would never be in a Pulis team. So So I just think that the teams above them, Norwich, that can be caught by Villa, and obviously they beat them here. I just think Sunderland, Newcastle, Swansea, Bournemouth, the teams ahead of them are not going to drop enough points. That having been said, credit to Remy Gard. He's kept it together. They got this result. They played well of late. And the reality is that they bought nobody in the window. And there were rumors all week long that he was going to walk. Neil Ashton reported it on NBC the night of the transfer deadline that, look, if it's possible Gard will walk this week. Because he didn't get any reinforcements, team spirit has remained high.
Let's move to Newcastle, West Brom. A good performance from Newcastle, although it was only a 1-0 victory. Keep going back to West Brom, Karthik. You and I are hitting the baggies hard because it just seems to be getting worse. Another match with no shots on target. This against a relegation and battle team. I was about to say fellow relegation and battle, but it's unclear that West Brom is really in this relegation picture. They're 6 points above the drop. They're playing as poorly as any team in the league, but that 6 points is a pretty big gap, it seems like.
It does seem like a pretty big gap. Can they draw their way out of trouble? If we think the number is 36, 37, 38, it looks like they'll get there on 29 points. Now, having been said, the teams that are around them in the table, Chelsea is obviously better than them. Bournemouth is better than them. Swansea is better than them. Newcastle, who are 5 points behind them and beat them in this game, I think just on the surface of things should catch them. So who's to say that they don't get sucked in?
Can't we just promote four teams from the championship?
Yeah, and drop West Brom even if they're not 17.
Or just at least drop Pulis. The final game we haven't talked about, Swansea versus Crystal Palace. Some good news here for both teams. Swansea has pulled their way out of the drop, so now these one-point results really are positives. Gylfi Sigurdsson with I want to say a good goal here, but I think Wayne Hennessy could have stopped it, 13th minute free kick. That just curved right inside the left post. Crystal Palace, scrappy goal from Scott Dan, got a result for a Palace team that's been in free fall lately. So in that respect, Kartik, I guess this is kind of a silver lining result for both sides.
Oh, this is an important with Palace to get this point. They desperately need something. And Adebayor played up top. He made a mistake, which led to the free kick, which led to the Swansea goal. But he looked more active than... I remember Adebayor. Then again, at the beginning in clubs, he's more active, right? We've come to
maybe
that
it's the hair. Maybe he's got some hair power going.
Yeah, right. We hadn't seen him in a year. Yeah. He looks different.
If people haven't seen Crystal Palace play, Emmanuel Adebayor has hair down to the middle of his back right now, which is good. It's a good look. It's a strong look.
important point for Swansea, as you mentioned. I think what we're seeing for Swansea now is that they're getting results. They're confident again. Sigurdsson is producing, and the lack of having goals from the striker position, which has been the downfall for them this season, isn't hurting them as much now. They're getting goals again from midfield. Will that last? I don't know. They still need to get about 10 more points to stay up. I think they will. I think Gudelin is a strong enough manager. Again, I don't know why he took this task on. It's kind of a thankless job, but I think they're going to have enough to stay on.
Gudelin, another example of a manager bringing some tactics into England, having short-term success.
Yeah, he was if you watch him in Udinese, he was a really good tactical manager. And yes, he had Alexis Sanchez and some other guys that
Total
we know.
Di Natale.
Yeah, Di Natale. Well, Di Natale, of course, but other guys that have moved on to bigger clubs. But tactically, they were really sound. And yeah, it was a period when the Milan clubs were down. But I think so much of Udinese's success those years were because of his management, or at least his tactical management. I don't know how he is in the dressing room or as a man manager, but he's very, very good tactically. We're seeing it again now for Sunderland. Some very kind of formations and squad selections that make you scratch your head, but then it comes out okay.
Well, he's getting his best players on the field, and they've found a new unique way to do that. We're seeing in the defensive phase, often Sigurdsson is their highest player, even though they're playing really just a midfield diamond, but they're splitting Routledge and IU wide. They're having them follow the fullbacks a little bit, and it looks weird, but it's working, obviously. They're unbeaten in their last four. I have claimed 8 points from those games. Everybody, we don't have very much action midweek. If you're a Liverpool or West Ham, or if you're a West Brom fan, hats off to you. You do have action midweek with your FA Cup replays, but we're going to be coming back to you in midweek focused on the 26th round of action in the Premier League, where Leicester will continue to try to get their stranglehold on the Premier League when they go to the Emirates to face Arsenal. Until then, for everybody at the World Soccer Talk family, I'm Richard Farley. Kartik,
enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is NipunChopra7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com.